Hi, this is Bill Thomas, and it's time for our Sunday special, Prairie Public Presents. When you think of Grammy Award-winning musicians from North Dakota, you might think Peggy Lee, Johnny Lang, but this? Well, okay, Peter Schickele, who composed that distinctive bit of music, was not born in North Dakota, and he doesn't live here now, but he spent some important formative years here. Listen to his account of his arrival in the back of the family car.
After our vacation stop, we continued on to Fargo. We drove in through the back door of town, and there were all these grain elevators and warehouses and a string of crummy businesses. I remember my mother in the front seat of the car crying softly.
We'll hear that again in a few moments in a little more context, because Professor Schickele came back for the North Dakota premiere of his new piece with the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony and took advantage of the situation to present some memories of his years on the northern prairie.
Thank you. My family moved to Fargo in 1947 when I had just turned 12, and my brother David was 10. We had lived in Washington, D.C. during the Second World War. My father worked for the Department of Agriculture, and my mother worked for the Quartermaster Corps. After the war, my father took a job as head of Agricultural Economics Department of North Dakota Agricultural College, as it was then called. We drove out here from D.C. in the summer of 1947 in the family car with our dog, Ricky. We had never been to Fargo, and it was right after the Second World War, and housing was hard to come by. So my parents had bought a house sight unseen with the help of some friends or somebody in the department. We made a stop in Jackson, Wyoming, which became a favorite destination for summer vacations for many years after that. In fact, our family still goes there. After our vacation stop, we continued on to Fargo. We drove in through the back door of town, and there were all these grain elevators and warehouses and a string of crummy businesses. I remember my mother in the front seat of the car crying softly as we drove in. I will just jump ahead to say that the years in Fargo were maybe the best years of their lives. Turned out to be just great people here, and my parents had a wonderful life here. They were wonderful years for my brother and me as well. There were many ways in which Fargo, I would say, was the high point of our young lives. We had great friends, and they were very happy years for us. Fargo is where I got interested in music. Aside from listening a bit to classics like Peter and the Wolf, I wasn't particularly interested in music when I was younger. I was definitely not a child prodigy. At the very end of our time in D.C., I got introduced to Spike Jones. Does everybody know who Spike Jones was? Okay. And I became a fan. For those of you who might not know, Spike Jones was a musician and comedian who was quite popular in the 40s. He had a comedy band called Spike Jones and his City Slickers. I remember the first time I heard Spike Jones. I was in a record store, and there was a sappy love song in the background. I wasn't listening to the words. And then suddenly the song got interrupted by two gunshots. And then it took off into this neo-Dixieland sound. And that was my introduction to Spike Jones. The song was Serenade to a Jerk. We made a little theater in the basement of our house in D.C. Where we would act out Spike Jones records, my brother and I and our friends. We also did plays with scripts, mostly like the westerns we saw on Fridays, with fist fights, and we had our cowboy outfits and cap guns. Our curtains were two U.S. Army bedspreads on a wire. Kids from the neighborhood would come and see our shows. We called it the Nitzo Theater. Nitzo was a slang term in our crowd in D.C. that meant neat or good, as in, man, that's really Nitzo. Our parents didn't like the idea of money being a part of it, but on the other hand, they recognized that having some type of admission fee was part of the deal. So our entrance fee was one penny. We had one grown-up show, which meant that it didn't have any fist fights in it. And we were allowed to charge two pennies for that play. for reserved seating. The Nitso Theater was just starting when we left and moved to Fargo. My brother and I had just gotten a movie camera. In D.C., I had a paper route. I was saving up my money from it to buy a movie camera so David and I could make movies. Then I lost David's cowboy hat from our matching cowboy outfits, and my folks made me buy him a new hat with my paper route money. David didn't want a new hat, of course. He wanted the movie camera. But my parents felt there was a principle at stake here. Deus ex machina. Then I got an award for being such a good paper deliverer, and the prize money was just enough to get a camera. So we were all set. Once we were here in Fargo, we set up the Nitso Theater in our basement. We had a bedspread, two bedspreads for curtains, and a stage area, and some lighting. By this time, my brother and I had started a sort of Spike Jonze-type band, Jerky Gems and His Bommy Brothers. We had two clarinets, violin, and tom-tom. It was me and John Helgeson on clarinet, my brother David on violin, and George Tharlson on drums. I was Jerky Gems, and my brother was Dripwater Squirt Fountain. We're talking a class act here. I'm not sure what the other names were. I think it's safe, excuse me, I think it's safe to say that most, if not all, of my early musical efforts were for Jerky Gems and His Bommy Brothers. I recently came across a news clipping from 1948 from the Fargo Forum with a picture of us performing a version of the Song of the Volga Boatman that involved George Tharlson and Don Stephenson pulling a 5-inch boat across the stage while John Helgeson, my brother, and I are playing in the background. The caption says, "Director and clarinetist and sound effects man Peter Schickele, who also arranges for the band," nothing self-centered about me, "reports that he found transposing the piece for two clarinets and violin more difficult than he had anticipated." The Nitso Theater also continued doing plays. The news clipping I found had a picture of a scene from one production, The Pony Express, which seemed to involve my brother getting ready to trip George Tharlson, who was about to stab John Helgeson, who was holding me up at gunpoint. My brother and I were also involved in the community theater here. I did the kid shows like Tom Sawyer and sometimes played a kid role or a young adult part in the adult productions as well. In one of them, I was scheduled to kiss the girl I had a crush on, but then she dropped out. I remember one show had a guy, an adult from Fargo, who just would not learn his lines. And one of my memories of that play is the look of panic in the woman playing opposite him as she waited for something, anything, that would give her a cue as to what her next line was. He would just make stuff up, and she would have this look of horror in her face. I loved the theater and loved doing those shows. I took piano lessons with a friend of the family named Virginia Jensen. My mother had a clarinet that she had played in college, and I started fooling around on that, too. Fargo, at that point, had a very good clarinetist named Bertram McGarity. He taught at one of the colleges. So I went to take clarinet lessons with Bert, and he listened to me, and he said, "Peter, you've got so many bad habits on clarinet, it would be easier for you to start a new instrument." And he suggested the bassoon, which I had never regretted. It wasn't until later that I found out that the Fargo-Moorhead Community Orchestra, as it was then called, needed a bassoonist, as they didn't have any at the time, so Bert had a motive in his suggestion. I played bassoon in the band at high school and joined the orchestra. My high school friend, who became the other bassoonist in the orchestra, was Meyer Osterfield. Meyer and I were both quite passionate about music. And I remember one time the conductor taking us aside and saying, "You know, You're playing the bassoon, an instrument that sticks out above the orchestra, and it's very visible. I wonder if you guys could cool it and stop moving around so much. Apparently, we were very emotional in our playing. I always enjoyed playing, but I was frustrated because I didn't have a bassoonist to study with. McGarity was a clarinetist, so I took lessons with him, but I never learned things like how to make reeds or even how to fashion them. If you play on store-bought reeds, they're pretty crummy, so it was the downside. But on the other hand, I was one of the only bassoonists around, so I got to play a lot. It was either me or Meyer Osterfield, that was it. Later in college, I got to play in a Schutz Festival, someone organized in the Philadelphia area that I probably wouldn't have been able to play with if I were not a bassoonist. Excuse me, try not to do that again. My mother, Beth, started playing double bass in Fargo-Moorhead Community Orchestra because they needed a double bass player. My brother David was on viola. David had started violin lessons in Washington and then switched to viola in Fargo. It was a great switch for him. He was a natural on the viola. It was during that time that my brother and I discovered chamber music. We had regular chamber music evenings. Neighbors would come over and play through various pieces in the living room. It would be at our house or at the home of Sigvald Thompson, who was a cellist and composer and the conductor of the orchestra, and his wife, Isabel, who was the concert mistress. It was a mix of adults and kids, and it was just wonderful. I didn't usually get to play because the repertoire was almost always for strings, but my brother David would be on viola, and once in a while I'd play if there was something that called for bassoon. They'd play Mozart and Beethoven quartets, sometimes Brahms or Schumann or Haydn. My father played flute, but it was hard to get him to play. We had what we called the family orchestra, which was the four of us, and he would sometimes could be coaxed into going along with it, but he didn't really enjoy playing. David became a fanatic chamber music player, and he put a lot of energy into organizing the evenings. That's definitely one of my fondest memories of Fargo, the chamber music evenings. Other players included Betty Quam and Margaret Strahl. We also did things like an opera written by Burt McGarity, which friends performed in our living room. That opera included my father doing a poem in German called The Stork, which was his party trick. It was also here in Fargo that I wrote my first musical composition. It was a piece called The Sheik of Palamazoo, for no particular reason. I have no explanation for the title other than it sounded a little Eastern. I wrote at least one piece for violin and piano for my brother and me to play as well. I was writing a lot for Jerky Gems, too. When I was a teenager, I used to get up early and go hang out at the local radio station WDAY so I could watch the house band for a while before going to school. It was just so exciting being around live musicians. The band would play numbers during the shows and do little themes and the transitions between programs, and different lineups of musicians would play during the different radio shows. For some shows, it might be just three guys. Other times, it was a small-sized big band, eight people or something like that. Hank and Thelma were country singers, and they just had backup bass and guitar, and then they'd have a full polka band for other programs. Orville Nellermo was the bass player. Not only does he have a great name, he was a great bass player. And he was a sweetheart of a guy. I got my first ear training watching him play. Ear training means knowing what you're hearing, which for a composer is important. He wasn't playing from written parts. He was playing from chord symbols, C7, D8, D9. I didn't really know much theory at that point, but I knew what the strings on the bass were. So if I saw him pluck an open D string and it was the key note, I knew it was in the key of D. I got into this thing with him where I would guess what key he was playing in, and I'd signal it, and he would let me know if I got it right or not. If I thought it was in D major with two sharps, I'd hold up two fingers. If it was two flats, I'd hold two fingers down. I don't know how we got away with all this with Frank Scott playing the piano and pretty serious about his job, but we got away with it. I don't know how we got started with it, but we went along with it, and the better I got at guessing, the higher up on the fingerboard he would get to make it harder to guess. And he'd use fewer open strings to make it harder for me to figure out what key it was in. Remember, in a situation like this, he was not playing written out parts. He was playing usually from chord symbols, so he had the choice of the actual notes to play. We had to keep an eye out because the band leader, Frank Scott, was all business. So Orville was careful not to go too far with it. If it was something like a polka, Frank wasn't necessarily involved. But the closer to jazz it got, the more Frank was around. Our family lived in an ordinary wooden house with two stories at 1354 North 12th Street. My brother's room was at the front of the house, and there was a gable outside the window. And he had something rigged up so that he could lie outside and look up at the stars. Very romantic, my brother. My room is at the back of the house, and I painted it some ungodly combination of colors. We had a piano in the living room and a record player. There was a rule that we couldn't listen to Oklahoma, which we loved, more than once a day. And we couldn't listen to Spike Jonze records when my dad was home, since he did not share our enthusiasm for those. My mother wasn't working as much as she would have liked in those years, but she did do some work at the hospital. She was often at home with us, which was different from D.C., where she worked full time. My dad was home mostly on the weekends. He and my brother and I used to read the Sunday comics together. That was a little ritual that we had. I attended Fargo Junior High School, and then I went to Fargo High. We walked to school each day, and we did it in some pretty low temperatures, as you know, though it didn't keep us from the finer things in life. I remember coming back during a blizzard one time, and we stopped in on the way for some ice cream. I was a good student. Another news clip I came across recently has a story about me winning a prize for my knowledge of the U.S. Constitution. I'm glad I don't have to take that exam now. I remember a teacher named Mr. Wrongly in high school. And you remember him? Yeah, okay. We were supposed to do a book report every 6 weeks, but I made a deal with Mr. Wrongly that I could make a movie instead, and it would count for the whole semester of a book report. And I did make a movie called The War Before the War. It was about the lead-up to the Civil War. I remember there was one scene that had me playing a guy drunk on corn whiskey. I can't deny that I saved the best parts for myself. I had another teacher who had a speech impediment, which meant that he pronounced his letter P as F, so he called me Feet. We certainly never teased him about it to his face, but I couldn't resist writing a song. Fleas fast your papers forward, pencils on your desk, fast to the FEF assembly now. Fight, team, fight, fulverize their might, prove to them that patriots can fave the way to fame. Fleas fast your papers forward, pencils on your desk, front's the final column of each guy. We've got power, we've got force, and we'll yell our own lungs hoarse for famous Fargo High. I feel confident that he never heard that song. One of my closest friends in high school was Skip Schiebold. He was perhaps unusual among my friends in that he wasn't particularly musical, but we were very good friends. My first girlfriend was Patty Vogel. She was a wonderful girl, very lively. In Fargo, our family started going to church for the first time because my parents thought we should be exposed to religion. We went to two different churches during that time, both congregational. The pastor of one of them was a very free-spirited guy. I remember one of his sermons was called, "Bingo, Bango, Bongo, I Don't Want to Leave the Congo." which was a popular song at that time. I always worked jobs in the summer. Sometimes I had a job after school, too. I worked for our friend Eddie Strauss, who had a clothing store, packing up suits to be sent to various places and steam vacuuming the floor, wherever, whatever he needed. One summer, I got a construction job. I wasn't exactly a natural for that. I would do things like dig out an entire area when I was supposed to just dig a trench. One of my least glamorous jobs was cleaning typewriters. I had to brush each key and soak them in a vat of acid to get the ink off. That was really unpleasant. I learned to drive in those years. I remember one time my brother and I were making a movie, and it called for me to be driving, and I only had a learner's permit. So my mother lay down in the back seat of the car so she would be out of sight, but in the car. We had a red convertible in those days. That movie was called Rocky Stone Rolls On. Rocky Stone was a detective, and there was a scene involving finding a corpse down by the river. We had an old bayonet that somebody had given us, and at the end of the movie, it featured a fight with the bayonet. The last shot was my brother lying on the floor with Hershey's chocolate coming out of his mouth. Looks just like blood in black and white movies. I graduated from Fargo in 1952, and then I went off to Swarthmore College outside of Philadelphia, where my brother joined me for two years later. My father got a job with the United Nations, and my parents left Fargo for Rome, Italy, where they lived for several years. After college, I moved to New York to go to Juilliard and have lived there ever since. Over the years, I've been back here a few times to do PDQ Bach concerts. The place has always been special to me. They were very happy years for me and my family, and musically, Fargo is really where it all started for me. I'm glad to have a chance to share these memories, and I'd be glad to answer some questions, but before I finish, I'd just like to say about my mother. She was trained as a scientist, and she worked for the Quartermaster Corps during the Second World War. When she got here, she worked various jobs in a hospital for a while. As she was trained as a scientist, she was trained as a physicist. And I remember talking with her once about the end of life. And she said, well, I was trained as a scientist, and so I believe that your body is a machine, and when the machine stops working, you die, and that's the end of it. And then she said, but if I'm wrong, I'll be very interested. Thank you. I'd like to tell one more story that I see I left off my notes, which is that I studied with a composer named Roy Harris in Pittsburgh during the time I was in college. And there was a polio epidemic that summer in Pittsburgh, the last one. It was the year that the Salk vaccine came out. But I got polio and had to go into the hospital. My parents had just moved to Rome, and I was studying with this composer, Roy Harris, and his wife, who was a real Florence Nightingale kind of person. She took care of me, and I was in the hospital in Pittsburgh. I was in a room with three other guys, all of them younger than I. And, one of them older and the rest are younger. And we had about as good a time as you can have having polio. There was a popular song then, Mr. Sandman, send me a dream. I remember, and one of the lines was, give him a fair complexion like Pagliacci, and lots of wavy hair like Liberace. And so we, in the four of us in that room, we all had radios, each one of us by our bed. And when that song came on, we'd all make sure we were tuned to the same station, and then we'd get our hands on the volume knob, Give him a lonely heart like Pagliacci, and lots of waving hair like Liberace. Then some doctor would come in and remind us that we were in a hospital.
We're going to pause from Peter Schickele's reminiscences about his life in Fargo to talk with Linda Boyd. She's the executive director of the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony and facilitated Peter's visit here and this talk that we are hearing today. And she and I talked a little bit about how it came about. So I'm curious, when did you first hear of Peter Schickele?
Oh, my goodness. I was in high school in the 70s. And my friend introduced me to his music. It was kind of like Monty Python at the time. Or what's that radio show I'm trying to think of?
The Goon Show.
The Goon Show that all the cool kids were into. So, yeah, that's when I got introduced to it. And in college, then it became a much bigger deal.
Right.
All the cool kids had his LPs. With P.D.Q. Bach, to a music major, it was just so deliciously naughty. You know, it was just such a straight line of here's what we're studying and, you know, memorizing and tests and learning how to analyze string quartets. And then he just makes a big spoof of it all. It was fantastic.
Yeah. And a spoof totally from the inside. So this isn't like Chuck Berry singing Roll Over Beethoven.
No. Yeah. He knows how to write a fugue inside and out, and then he just throws a few curveballs.
Yeah.
And then, you know, knowing that he was from Fargo just made it so much cooler.
Right. How did it come that he's coming back to Fargo this time?
So we were contacted by pianist Jeffrey Beagle a few years ago. Jeffrey is an incredible pianist in his own right, but one of his big missions and projects is to go around the country and do these multi-orchestra commissions and then get different composers writing new pieces for piano. And he loves crossing over into the popular realm. So even though he didn't commission Keith Emerson from Emerson, Lake and Palmer, he's been a real champion of that piece. He wrote a concerto. So he had always loved P.D.Q. Bach, you know, always been a huge fan. And had approached Peter Schickele many years ago, and it wasn't the right time. So he tried approaching him again, and he agreed to do it. So that's when we were approached. So we knew this was in the works.
And so this is a group of orchestras pool their money to commission a piece.
Exactly right. And then those commissioning orchestras usually all perform it within a season or two. And so that's where we were at.
Originally, there was a plan for the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony to do Carnival of the Animals with Peter Schickele as narrator. Then they heard he was ill and couldn't come. And then
out of the blue, I got a phone call from Peter Schickele's personal assistant saying, you know, Peter would like to come to Fargo to hear to hear the orchestra, his hometown orchestra, perform this piece. Would that be okay? And he'd like to be able to give a talk. He wants to give a talk about his Fargo memories. Would that be okay? Then there's this clatter as I fell to the floor. And yeah, of course, that would be fantastic. So that's how that came about. So in talking with Peter's daughter, who came along with him, Carla, she was saying that it became clear that once Peter wasn't going to be able to go to the premiere in Colorado, and it wasn't being performed anywhere in New York, where he lives, that if he was going to hear it, he was going to have to travel. And then it was like, well, hands down, I want to go to Fargo. So it was fantastic. So this was the only version that he heard live.
So surprised and pleased to hear that he's writing his autobiography.
Yeah, he had said, I would like to share my memories of living in Fargo, making music with people in Fargo. He would, when he was a teenager, he would go into his buddies' homes and they'd sit around and play chamber music together. And so it was a huge part of his life growing up.
Yeah, no, I remember the time before when he was here, he talked so much about how just the casual music making that went on was so helpful to him as a forming musician.
And I think one of the things that he particularly enjoyed and may have really helped create that persona where he was so wide open in his musical tastes was it was such an open community in terms of what you could do. So he was playing in the orchestra, the Fargo Moorhead Symphony. At the time, it was much more of a community orchestra. He was studying composition with Sigvald Thompson, who was a professor at Concordia. He was just making music across generations with kids his age and adults and people his grandparents' age, you know. And plus, he was really interested in pop music at the time and, you know, baseball and everything else. So it all just kind of cooked in that. And then he has just this loony sense of humor. So this all just cooked up into that unique stew, and this Petey Kubat character started as a kind of a student fun project when he was at Juilliard, and then it just took off and it became his career. And then you must be, I would guess, a fan of Schickele Mix, which was his long-running show on National Public Radio that was all about all kinds of music in the world, you know, world folk music, jazz, rock, blues, classical, you know, all international kinds of things, and what they had in common. And he could pick a thread through so many of those things. I mean, he was just such a genius in how he understood music from so many directions.
So what kind of reactions did you get after the concert and his presentation?
His piece was his Concerto for Simply Grand Piano and Orchestra. And at the last minute, there was this bit, you know, so it's funny. It's got these funny kind of jokes in it.
Right.
And there was a bit where Jeffrey Beagle, the piano soloist, was supposed to stand up and do a little tap dance bit of business. And it was like, yeah, that's that's a problem. And so it's like, hey, we should get a tap dancer. So this is part of my job in, you know, 24 hours to get a tap dancer.
Oh, so that was, wow, you got a good one.
Oh, right?
It worked wonderfully.
It was fantastic. So we got Mateo. He is a premier dancer, but he's young, I think 14 or something, with Gasper School of Dance, and he just nailed it. You know, would come in off stage, kind of upstage him, and then kind of skitter away, but it was all very choreographed to the music.
Right,
you know,
right.
Kind of on the spot the night before.
Yes, it was a wonderful conglomerate piece of performance with a little bit of piano versus the orchestra.
Yeah, a little of that.
And some jazz that could have been right from Spike Jonze and his City Slickers thrown in.
Yep, a little ragtime and little musical jokes. And
crazy.
And his music is just, you know, even if you're not a big classical music buff, it's pretty obvious humor and it's just a lot of fun. So audiences loved it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, congratulations on a great concert and bringing Peter Schickele back again.
Thank you so much. Thanks for sharing this with all of your listeners. It's just such a treat.
Well, okay. Back to Professor Peter Schickele, otherwise sometimes known as Petey Kubat, and his thoughts about his time in Fargo, North Dakota.
Okay.
Does anyone
have any questions?
Yeah, I'm glad to answer some questions if anybody has any. How did I discover Petey Kubat? How did that happen? Well, I mentioned Spike Jonze, so that was the beginning of it. Spike Jonze, I was introduced in Washington, D.C., and then continued through my years in Fargo. And when I was a student at Juilliard, I did the first humorous concert at Juilliard. And it became a tradition at Juilliard at the end of the year. And then eventually I started doing the concerts publicly in Town Hall and Carnegie Hall. And so what was the question?
How did you come up with the idea?
Yeah. Oh, how did I come up? Well, as I say, the broad answer is Spike Jonze. I was already into making fun of music. The specific idea of coming up with Petey Kubat, I think, was that there are some composers with some fairly funky names out there, for real. And so my brother and I, we did a piece called the Sanka Cantata after listening to Bach's Coffee Cantata. And I think that was the beginning of it. And then when I was a student at Juilliard, I used to sit around the cafeteria with friends, and we'd talk about funny things we'd seen happen at concerts or that we'd like to see happen at concerts. And one day somebody who'd been sitting at our table with us came up and he said, "You know, I organize the special concert events here at Juilliard. Would you guys like to do a concert along the lines of what these stories you've told?" So we put on the first humorous concert in 1959 in Juilliard, with George Mester was the conductor, and it became an annual tradition there. And later I went to the music school at Aspen, and became a tradition there as well. And somehow I got into this, perhaps because my father and I and my brother used to climb mountains. We went to the Tetons whenever we could in Wyoming. So I made an entrance in the Aspen Opera House, with a rope coming down from the balcony. And I made an interesting discovery when I listened to the tape of that show, that if you do something that's wild enough as an entrance, and preferably a little scary, certainly was for me, the audience will laugh at almost anything. So that was the beginning of what became a traditional entrance. It actually got to be a bit of a chore sometimes. Every year I tried to have a different entrance. But it was a fine tradition. And the highlight of which, I think, was a couple of years I literally swang in on a rope from the balcony to the stage of Carnegie Hall, like Tarzan. Scary as hell. So finally, I got old enough to give that up. Anybody else? Yeah.
Peter, I'm Nick Vogel.
Hi, yeah.
Folks were good friends. Do you still have that cabin in the Tetons?
Have that? Yes, we did. We still have. Ask me if I still have a cabin in the Tetons. My family bought a cabin built in the Tetons. My parents went there every year that they could, and my family still goes there whenever we can. Yeah.
Yeah, I taught at New York Mills back in 1960, and the best teaching tool I ever had to teach a form of symphony was your Symphony No. 5, played by New York Philharmonic, New York Mills Philharmonic
Orchestra. Yeah, he's referring to a thing I did at Vanguard, the first movement of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, as a sporting event, with me and another guy calling the plays. And, of course, I hadn't really thought about it that much before, but I realized after doing it that part of what made it funny is that we really were describing what was going on in the music. And so it became a teaching tool. Used all over the country.
Well, okay, I can't resist breaking in again here, because this piece that Peter and the questioner are talking about is probably the most beloved of Peter's humorous works. It is New Horizons in Music Appreciation, and we're going to hear some of it now. We'll be back to Peter's questions and answers after that.
Good evening, music fans. Here we are at Philharmonic Hall in New York Mills, Minnesota. It's a beautiful night for a concert. There's not a cloud in the ceiling. And there's quite a crowd out here. About how many do you think there are, Bob?
Oh, I don't know, Pete.
Well, neither do I, but it's quite a crowd. And I think they're looking forward to hearing the New York Mills Philharmonic playing against the Danish conductor, Heilige Dankesang. And here he comes now, ascending the podium. And the players are all lined up and ready to begin the first inning of Beethoven's Symphony No. 5 in C minor. And they're off with a four-note theme. This is very exciting. The beginning of a symphony is always very exciting, folks. I don't know whether it's slow or fast yet because it keeps stopping. It doesn't seem to be able to get off the ground yet. And it looks like, yes, it looks like we're coming up to a cadence here, folks. The violins didn't cut off there. A little trouble with the violins. They weren't watching. And there's that four-note theme again, folks. And another stop. Just can't seem to get this piece off the ground. Now it seems to be rolling a little bit. Seems to be building up. Tell me, Bob, Do you think you'd call that four-note idea a theme or a motif?
Well, Pete, the technical term would be motif, which he uses to build a theme.
I see. Thanks for setting me straight about that, Bob. Well, we're heading into the second theme section here, and we can expect a little modulation down there. Wow, did you hear that, Bob? Somebody down there in the horn section really flubbed that note. That was one of the worst fumbles I think I've ever witnessed in all my days. I think it was number one, wasn't it, Bob?
Yes, it was, Pete. That was Bobby Corno in the first chair, and that's the third major flub he's made this season, giving him a solo average for the season of approximately .247355, which is pretty darn low for a first chair man.
You think there's some chance he might be sold to another orchestra?
Well, it's hard to say, Pete. Corno's very good in the long solos, things like the Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto. So I think if he pulls himself together a bit, they'll probably keep him around, although I suppose he might...
Well, I think it's development time down there now, Bob. Let's see what's going to happen. The horns are starting it off. They seem to be in pretty good shape now, and I get the feeling that we're probably going to be hearing a lot of that four-note motif, don't you, Bob?
Yes, I do, Pete.
So do I, Bob. Well, they obviously are stuck with that four-note motif, and they're going to be fooling around with it for quite a while. You notice it's pretty hot in here, Bob?
Yes, I do, Pete.
Yeah, I think the air conditioning has gone off, which is just one of the things... Wait a minute, there's something going on down there on the stage, folks. There's something happening down there. It's really building up tension. The crowd is getting very excited. The brasses have come in, and the timpani, and everybody, and it's extremely exciting. I think we're building up to a fugue. No, the basses are not picking up the theme, folks. It is not a fugue. The violins tried to make it one, but the basses are not following up. No, instead of a fugue, folks, he seems to be taking the theme and breaking it up into little pieces. Just two notes left of that theme now being thrown around from player to player. And it's getting softer and softer down there, folks. I think they're losing steam. They seem to be running out of steam. And it's just getting a little bit lethargic down there, if you want to know the truth. It's gotten down to one note now. And things are... Wait a minute! The brasses have come in and tried to pep things up. A welcome relief. But I'm afraid to no avail. Things are still pretty soporific. Wait a minute. They hear they come again. They're really determined. It sounds very familiar. And I think we've reached the recap, Bob, don't you?
There's no doubt about it, Pete. Your average Beethoven symphony usually has a recap right after the second quarter, and this one is falling right into line.
Well, let's see if those violins can cut off with the rest of the orchestra, and the cadence is coming up. Wait a minute. This time it's the oboe holding the note too long. Wait, he's playing a cadenza. He must be out of his mind. He thinks it's an oboe concerto. The conductor's standing down there. He doesn't know what to do. Have you ever heard anything like that, Bob?
I certainly haven't, Pete. I think it was a disgraceful display of lack of teamsmanship. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if Highwood's name wasn't on the roster next season, although I must say that the fans really seem to go for these outbursts of temperament.
Well, I always say, Bob, professional music teams wouldn't exist without the spectators. Anyway, we're into the home stretch here with the second theme coming up, and we should be in C minor right up to the double bar. Wait a minute. That's really something, Bob. The piece's build is being in C minor, and yet it looks like it's going to end in C major.
It's really something, Pete.
Well, I think it's something that the Composers Commission ought to look into, and I suspect that they will as soon as this gets out. But it looks like it's going to be an ending anyway. Things are building up a little there. The violins have really...
Okay, as much as we could fit in of New Horizons in Music Appreciation, and now we return you to Peter Shickley and his audience, brought in by the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony and recorded in the spring of 2017.
Anybody else?
Hello?
Yep.
So many of us fondly remember your radio show, the Peter Shickley Mix, and my question is how you came up with... the idea that you graduated from the University of South Dakota in Hoople. I wanted to know if you've ever been to Hoople.
Right. Did you hear the question?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, now you hit a sore point there. I've never been to Hoople. Some of the older among you, like myself, may remember there was a comic strip called Our Boarding House. In the 40s, with Major Hoople, was one of the people who stayed in the boarding house. And that's where I got the name. And of course, I used to listen, just living here, I'd hear on the radio programs that gave the scores, the basketball scores from around the state and things like that. And I ended up incorporating that into some of those broadcast things. But
But that's how that came about. Yes.
Who have been some of your favorite professional musicians to collaborate with?
Favorite professional musicians to collaborate with? Well, I've had some wonderful experiences in that way. John Nelson is a conductor on one of the P.D.Q. Bach albums. He is a very, very fine conductor. George Mester was the conductor on the first P.D.Q. Bach album. He's also a very fine conductor. And I've worked with, you know, fantastic pianists like Emmanuel Axe, who for some reason agreed to do a concert. Fortunately, P.D.Q. Bach got a pretty good reputation from the early albums, and so some very good musicians would play in the P.D.Q. Bach concerts, which is not only a kick, but it's also important. One of the things that some people don't realize is that it has to be done well. It's not just sort of fooling around, you know. And so we would always get very good musicians to play.
You performed with the FM Symphony in about 1978. And during the performance, you were at the piano, and you pulled out a Playboy magazine.
Uh-huh.
And opened the centerfold.
Yeah.
I assume that was a reoccurring bit in your show. And I'm wondering if you settled on a favorite playmate.
Well, that was my favorite issue. Still got it. No, there are certain gags that the more outrageous they are, the better they go on, the better they go over. And particularly when you're dealing with classical music, which starts from an idea of being somewhat stuffy, you know, so that these outrageous things are even more outrageous. Yeah.
If you say you've never been to Hoople, you are invited to come.
Hey, I'm afraid I'm busy that night. Oh, great. Thank you. Great. Yes?
Were you influenced by Victor Borge at all?
Was I influenced by Victor Borge? Yes. Yes and no. I saw him first when I was here in Fargo, along with Spike Jonze. His stage act came here. And I saw Victor Borge as well. And I always loved him, but his... Part of his whole shtick was not getting around to playing, you know? So I was more involved in doing not only stage things, but also, of course, with P.D.Q. Bach, there's the whole music thing, in the fact of it being original music, but hopefully funny. And if you hear the P.D.Q. Bach piano concerto that's being done here, you'll see that it's I've always tried to have it be funny and worth listening to at the same time. So I tried to get that mix right. But I worked with Victor Borge very briefly. He wanted to know if I could come up with any ideas for him, so I did come up with one that he used, but in general, as I was sort of doing my thing and he was doing his. Yes?
Could you tell us about the oboe concerto? How is it that the Moscow Philharmonic came to debut that piece?
They didn't debut it.
Oh.
The Moscow Philharmonic playing my oboe concerto. That's news to me, by the way. I didn't know they had played it. I always, from the beginning, I studied as a serious composer, But I was a Spike Jonze freak, too. And I always played both sides of the fence there. I've always written serious music as well as the PDQ Box stuff. So, and the Oboe Concerto is a serious piece. I'm trying to remember the name of the person who commissioned Pam Peschuk. Yeah, thank you. But that's the only answer I have to that. It's they're really pretty separate. Yes?
When I was in college, I had the delight of singing one of your choral works, your more serious works, the E.E. Cummings.
Oh, yeah.
Do you feel like your serious work has been overshadowed by P.D.Q. Bach, or have you had a satisfying run with your serious works? Because it was just like a perfect piece.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. No, that's certainly something I've thought about. One of the reasons I'm glad I came up with the name P.D.Q. Bach and didn't use Peter Schickele for that was to have that those be separate. But I'm just, I knew that I'm too incorrigible to give up the P.D.Q. Bach thing entirely, although I'm getting old enough now so that everything seems funny to me now. But but I have always actually felt, and this is a thing, something saying in this occasion for this gig, which I've always felt that serious and funny are both equally serious. And since you have to work as hard on a funny piece as you do on a serious piece. And also you want to make it work as a piece. That's the secret ingredient. And so I've always done both. And I've always just hoped that people would put up with that. I've been lucky in that plenty of my serious pieces have been played all over the place too, so I've got a pretty nice life that way.
In your days in the Epworth Symphony, do you have any memorable musical remembrances of that or important things?
Playing in the symphony was one of the great experiences of my life. There's just nothing like playing music, and I never played a string instrument, so I couldn't participate in the chamber music evenings at home. And I don't play piano well enough to play the Brahms piano quintet or anything like that. So the nice thing about playing bassoon is that they always need bassoonists. I got to play in things I wouldn't have gotten to play in if I played clarinet. So that was a very fond experience, but I played it in college. But after that, when I got to Juilliard, there were real bassoonists around who knew how to make reeds, which I never found out about. So I gave that up.
I understand that you are a classmate of Philip Glass and worked with him quite a bit. What do you think of your P.D.Q. Bach take of Einstein on the Beach?
Oh, he enjoyed it. Yeah, did you hear the question?
Yeah.
I invited him to the first performance, and he definitely enjoyed it. We were buddies at Juilliard, so we hung out a lot together. And we traveled, one summer we traveled around in the West on motorcycles together, so we go way back. Anybody else? Yeah.
I was always inspired by your reminder at the end of your Schickele Mix show to the listener to remember that all music was once new. What would you hope that your impact, or what you would hope that people remember about your music, whether it's P.D.Q. Bach or Peter Schickele?
Well, Nirvana would be both, you know. I've never wanted to choose. Spike Jonze inoculated me when it came to humorous music, and I never got over that. But on the other hand, I've written so much serious music too. I've been quite fortunate in how much of it has been played and how much of it is published. But to me, they're just like two areas equally interesting. And so it's not a matter of, in my ideal world, I wouldn't have to choose. So, yeah.
Can I just share something? A good friend and I were students at Concordia College and huge fans of yours. And we wrote you a letter back in 1983.
Oh, yeah.
We sent you a request to write a piece for us, and we sent you like a quarter that had run over by a train. And
what was the end of that?
We sent you a quarter.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And you wrote us the most fabulous letter because my friend was Italian. And you said, you're Fargo Moore, you said the phrase, out of the weeds ran a thousand Swedes chased by one Norwegian. Uh-huh. And you said, how do you fit an Italian into that? And you encouraged us to play, and you said you'd do a dedicatory piece for us, and we chose to play your erotica variations.
Uh-huh.
And Roy Stahl was the head of the music department, and he glowered at us throughout the entire performance. And we got kicked out, I think. But you inspired us to enjoy the joy of the fun of music.
Great.
Being able to make fun of it. So I thank you so much for that.
Well, thank you. And I got to say that to me, one of the secrets, one of the things I try to do in PDQ Bach music is to make it, in addition to being funny, to make it good music as well, in the sense of that it works and is satisfying. And what makes it really satisfying is if it isn't only funny, if it works as a piece, you know. So I try. That's what I try to do. That's the goal. Yeah.
I just want to thank you for bringing such joy into music that, you know, I think kept music majors sane.
Joy is the key. Okay, one more.
Cocktails for two.
What?
Cocktails for two.
Didn't hear.
Cocktails for two.
Cocktails for two, right. I thought the last part was bassoon. Cocktails for two. Might have been, no, it wasn't the first Spike Jones I heard. My first Spike Jones was Serenade to a Jerk, which I heard at DeVoe's music store, walking around and somebody was listening to a record in one of the record booths, and this sappy love song. When I was 12 years old, there was nothing less interesting than a sappy love song. And then these two gunshots. And the music took off into this neo-Dixieland, and that was my introduction to Spike Jones. But I learned a very important lesson from Spike Jones, not that I knew him, but, and that is that to be really funny, it has to be done well. His band was terrific. It's just a great band, and those musicians could do whatever they wanted, and that was a lesson worth learning. And that's why I've been so lucky. When I started doing humorous concerts, I was a student at Juilliard, and so I had really good musicians around to play the stuff. Anybody else? Thank you.
Well, you've been listening to Peter Schickele, and as you heard, he spent much of his formative life in North Dakota, in Fargo, and had a great time doing it, and had a great time talking about it, and people had a wonderful time listening to it. The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony brought him in, and we're grateful to them and Peter Schickele for allowing us to have this recording, and we hope you enjoyed it. This is Prairie Public Presents. I'm Bill Thomas.